sublime books, study during this summer time. We have read a few chapters, and last time as we were closing the chapter on giving, that a rich man had asked the question that what is the meaning of giving, how should we be giving, and then it was described that you give very little when you give of your possessions. But when you give of yourself, then you really give. This is a very important thing to note. And then, as we were about to end, then we saw there is the new chapter coming up, and that is about eating and drinking. It begins like this. Then an old man, a keeper of an inn, said, "Speak to us about eating and drinking." The prophet is speaking. The prophet had formed a loving connection with the population there in this island. And now, before his time to depart, they have been urging him to give him some teachings. That is how the prophet, the God incarnation, comes to us for the purpose of teaching, educating. It is not possible for us ourselves to learn, and therefore the divine, which is the source of all wisdom, assumes a human form and thus imparts us the wisdom. And this wisdom at various level people are absorbing. We are all, although divine in principle, in manifestation we have our various stages of development. It is, let us just to picture it in terms of this Darwinian term of evolution of species. Even amongst human beings, although we are structurally very similar to each other, internally our minds are at various different stages of evolution, spiritual evolution. And therefore every person wants to know something that is causing an irritating problem for him or her. So, the first chapter was about love. Then there was the chapter about marriage. There was the chapter about children. The chapter about children, they are all very well connected chapters. It was very interesting to see, because it is people get naturally, because of that connection, very much entangled into children. And so the analogy that was given was very beautiful analogy, that you do not own the children. You are the bow and the arrow from which your children are shot like arrows. But the archer is different. You are not the archer. You may be bow and arrow, that's all. And then the archer, therefore, wants the arrow to fall far from the bow and arrow. It is stretched with strong hands, and so the arrow flies from the bow and that string and goes away. So it is very important that we look upon the children in that way. It is normally it is seen as very difficult, quite natural to think that it is difficult. But everything that is difficult by practice becomes easy. Just because it is difficult, we do not practice, then it never becomes easy. And tell me, friends, that is difficult, but is life otherwise very easy? Life means difficulties. Now the difficulties that take you in the right direction, the method that you use to solve the problems, one should see that whether they are taking me in the right direction or in the wrong direction. Difficulties, problems, that is part of life. That is bread and butter of life. Without difficulties, there is no human life. And every difficulty is actually an opportunity. Opportunity in the sense that is what makes us grow. If we do not take up that challenge of taking up this problem in the right spirit, solve it without compromising with our ideal, then that is the right way. If we buckle under the pressure of the difficulties, then what we will be doing? And thinking that, well, if I go in the right direction, if I keep on driving in the right direction, then I will be spending gas. If I go in the wrong direction, does my car run without any fuel? The same thing whether you go in right direction or wrong direction. But if you go in right direction, at least you will reach the destination. Otherwise, what is called samsara, the beautiful Sanskrit term samsara, means just going on the circular path, never reaching anywhere. Again and again, one takes up the body, just keeps on doing basically the same things in different forms. That's it. That is the what happens when you are going on a circular road. You see the same places again and again, over and over. That's about it. So it is like that. But if we take the right course, the situations change. So similarly now, we are taking up another thing that we all have to deal with every day. Every day, many times in fact. And what is it? Eating and drinking. It is. And that is a big problem. Every religion therefore has some rules, regulations about eating. And then they get again questioned as well. Because these regulations are not universal. And human beings forget the principle behind those regulations and then hold on to those regulations. There is a principle that is mentioned in all these, that control. You need to eat and drink perfectly understandable. But how that eating and drinking becomes an act of worship rather than an act of violence. Eating and drinking otherwise is an act of violence. That is how this discussion begins. Then an old man, a keeper of an inn, said, "Speak to us of eating and drinking." And he said, "Would that you could live on the fragrance of the earth and like an air plant be sustained by the light. But since you must kill to eat," and that is the very important thing, when we eat, we kill. There is no eating without killing, even if you are a very strict vegetarian, vegan, or whatever it may be, we kill By the very process of eating, we are killing. There is no way that one can escape killing while eating. But now what is to be done, since it is a given that eating means killing? If that is given, now what best can we do with it? We have to eat. Is there any other alternative? I mean, no choice in that matter. If we want to survive, we have to eat. Otherwise, we will be making violence again, and we will be killing this body. If not something else, I will be killing this body. So, therefore, we all have to eat. And therefore, this question arises here that while eating we have to kill. But since you must kill to eat and rob the newly born of its mother's milk to quench your thirst, let it then be an act of worship. The eating has to be made an act of worship. One may say every work, every act has to be made into a worship, but it applies very importantly, very much more to this act of eating, because in all other acts, of course, there is this idea of I am the doer that is done. In eating, this act of subject-object, enjoyer and enjoyed, is very, very powerful. That I am enjoyer, and this is this food, whatever it may be, this pasta, this pizza, this ice cream, all that, that is enjoyed. I am consuming them, and we say, wow, hey, it tastes so good. It is, that's wonderful. And so, the food creates this division very strongly, that I am the enjoyer, that the food is enjoyed. And this distinction in our experience is the very strong firmament of ignorance. It is this distinction is we can logically see as fictitious. And although it is part of all our actions, it comes very much on fore when we are eating, that yes, this is the nice, delicious thing, and I am eating it. We negate the presence of divine in it. We negate the presence of the same being in both. And therefore the act of worship is that it is, make it into an act of worship. It is, and let your bowl stand an altar on which the pure and the innocent of the forest and plain are sacrificed for that which is purer and still more innocent in man. We are killing something, we are destroying something. So, the act of worship, act of sacrifice is that in that act something purer is produced. Then it is justifiable that if that is killed, but from that something that is purer, more this the more innocent, as this expression says, that is how this act should become, that it is, let's make sure that something purer is raised while something is being killed. And that is the way that we should eat. In almost all religions that I know of, there is therefore a prayer that grace is said while you eat, because it is you feel the presence of God, and the prayers of grace are very beautiful prayers, like we chant here a verse from Bhagavad Gita, that it is Brahmarpanam, Brahma Havi, Brahma Agnau, Brahmana Hutam. It is like this, you know, imagine a fire in which oblation is being poured. And then what happens in that, the oblation, whatever you put, say firewood or the butter, etc., that gets burned, the fire flares up more. So the fire becomes the symbolic representation of the ideal. And what is sacrificed in the fire is something that is an obstruction in realizing the ideal. So you sacrifice that, that gets burned, and then the fire flares up. Now, as this process goes on, one gradually comes to the ideal. And now everything is seen as expression of ideal. That is therefore considered the ultimate sacrifice. That the one who is sacrificing, that is divine. In the fire in which it is being sacrificed, and that fire is divine. The oblations poured into it, that is divine. And the instruments like a ladle or spoon, that also is divine. And the result that comes from this worship, that also is the same one divine being. A beautiful analogy that a great saint Jnaneshwar gives, I will modify it more to, you know, to for understanding, that suppose there is a nice big stone, and a carving has been done by an artist on it. In the carving, it is a picture of worship. So worship is going on. There is a worshipper. There is a deity that is to be worshipped. There are those pots, pans, other utensils for worship. There are various articles of offering are kept there. And the act of worship is being very beautifully carved on that stone. And then that Saint Jnaneshwar says, imagine now, think that the rock on which it is all carved becomes alive. Now what will be the awareness of that rock? Well, I am the worshipper, isn't it? That rock is the worshipper. I am the deity that is being worshipped. I am all the articles that are being offered in that worship. I am all these things. So similarly, this awareness is to be aroused by us while taking food. And that is the purpose of that prayer, that the same reality is there in the eater as well as in the eaten. They are not really different. It is the food is this also is food, that also is food. It is for this purpose For temporary understanding, this is the eater that is the eaten, but actually the reality in both is the same. There is no violence intended in it, but a worshipful attitude. In Native American culture, therefore, it is so interesting to see the similar idea that when an animal or a bird is killed for eating, there is a prayer said to that, that, well, I am that feeling the same substance there, the soul, that is, they have some different tribes have different word, but that is same in all these. That is the substance, that is the most important thing, and that is there in the animal killed, and so it is prayed for, and with all due respect to the animal it is taken. It is very important to see that this eating becomes an act of worship. Then that eating goes to illumine our life. Illumine in the sense our true divine nature then gets manifested. Eating depends, you know, it is not easy for many who are attached to only the gross material part. But every thing has a subtle aspect to it that goes to feed the mind. The gross aspect feels the body. Well, you may say, well, this is I am eating a triple Mac. Okay, so it is that is the external part of it is bread, this, that, and that form gets destroyed as we eat. You can, as they say, you know, when eating means you destroy it. The famous saying is there, you cannot have the cake and eat it too. That if you have the cake, you can't eat it. When you eat it, it is gone. So, now once it goes, then at the physical level, its physical attributes start working in our system. The carbohydrates, the proteins, all that, they get properly assimilated, or if it is too much not assimilated, it is, and thus it goes for the physical nourishment, or if it is not the right kind of food or right quantity of food, then it makes our body worse. But there is this subtle aspect with what attitude we are taking the food, how the food has been prepared and so forth. That goes to make our mind pure. So there are foods which are, you know, basically because of being very strongly aromatic, they excite the mind. It is they like onions and garlics, and those who have very strong smell. So they, and therefore in many religious disciplines, it is advised don't eat that food because of its intrinsic capability of exciting the mind. And thus, a person is not capable of thinking right. The person thinks, but thinking right in the sense of thinking to get to the ideal, that is, that gets distracted, disturbed, And so it is advised, avoid that food. Of course, there are, you know, one should not carry it to ridiculous extremes, that it is as if it is the only thing. No, but there is therefore an element of subtle qualities of food. More important is the intention of taking food. That there is also, like in the Buddha's teachings, it has been given a lot of importance, that how have we earned a food by immoral means or moral means? Did we cheat people to earn money and then we are having this food? That certainly makes a difference in the effect of that food on mind. You may say, well, I might have cheated, but that fellow who is honest is also eating a hamburger, and I might have cheated, I might have stolen money, and I am eating the same hamburger. What difference does it make? Well, on the body it may not have any significant difference in effect, but on the mind there is an impact. That is, Buddha calls it in that eightfold path, that eightfold middle path, there is, I think it is fourth or fifth, Samyak Ajiva, that how one earns the livelihood, that is very important. And then another aspect is there, the intention behind eating. If one is eating as a matter of need, then it does not really hurt us much. But when it is eaten as a matter of greed, then it does hurt. Also, when we say the prayers and feel the presence of that one divine in both, that is being eaten and that is the one that is eater, then our mind gets that sense of purity by the food, that as if I am God, God is, feeling of God is aroused in me, like in the mass and Christians, the food is offered. Same with Hindus and many other, that the food is made into an offering to God. That God, you take it and then I will take it from you as blessings. Now if it is done sincerely, it does of course have its great effect, that it makes the food pure for us, that it is, we are taking in the packet called food. It is not that the food that we take maybe in a bowl, but then that food itself is a packet. Like the book, you may order a book, say at Amazon.com, and then you will get the book in a box. Now the box is the container, the book is the contained. But then when you read the book is the container and the knowledge that you get is the contained. So, when you are eating food well in a bowl, that bowl is the container, the food is the contained. Now when we are eating the food is a container, in which physical, on the physical level, there are the nutrients, and on the psychological, mental level, there are these, the qualities of stabilizing the mind or irritating the mind, disturbing it. So both these things are there, and we have to therefore make sure that we put in our efforts to invoke that sense of prayer while eating, so the food goes for mental calmness. It is like in Christians, you see that it is taken in, that it is Some believe it, some don't like to believe it, that it is the body of Jesus. Bread is the body of Jesus, and the wine is the blood of Jesus. And now, what does it mean? I am taking Jesus in me, and not as a person exactly, but Jesus has manifested in his teachings that I am taking within me. Yeah. Even if you don't take it as, because some people get horrified with the idea of eating Jesus' body, hey. So Protestants have a different this thing that it is the blessings of God that is being taken in. It all depends, you know, that every morsel of food that we are taking, and we should take with that attitude, that it is being given with blessings of God. Let me take it as something that is being given to me by God. Let me thank God for that reason and feel the presence of God in both. It will bring about a lot of change. There are many types of restrictions prescribed, and they vary from place to place, community to community. But the central principle is learn to control the drag towards eating just for liking. I like something, wow, so I go for it. It is, and I don't like something, but it is to be taken something. Therefore, in Hindus, you know, if something is given as an offered food, whether we like or we don't like, it is taken in as an act of piety, as an act of purifying ourselves by taking it in. One respectfully, reverentially takes it. So this is an idea in all eating. Shankaracharya describes that how one should take food, that it is, it should be taken as medicine. He says that Kshut vyadhi chikitsitam pratidinam bhikshaushadham bhujyatam. That take every day as a medication to this disease called hunger, the medication called food. So take it as medication. Medication, one takes medication to remove the affliction. The affliction is hunger or the physical need, and then the medication for that is food. So take it in that manner. Nobody ever takes medication out of liking. Hey, I like to. No, it is not. That medication is taken to remove some afflictions, some disease, some problem, and we take it whether we like it or we don't like it. Everybody has to do that. Our Anne used to say that every time she takes a that medication, I don't like Swami, it makes me kind of sick to take it. But she knew that she has to take it. It doesn't matter whether you like or you don't like. It is medicine, you have to take it. So food also should be taken with that attitude. It is medication. It is necessary. And when we take it with that attitude, that intake of food, that act of taking food becomes a worship. It does not hurt our mind then. So it is said, when you kill a beast, say to him in your heart, by the same power that slays you, that I too am slain, and I too shall be consumed. This is that it is very important to see this, you know, that it is same power that slays the eaten will also slay the eater. And we become food in the same way that we eat something else eats us up. It is, the process goes on. In Taittiriya Upanishad, therefore, a very beautiful, very sublime, intensely philosophical verse comes about this. It defines food. Food is defined there. Adyate atticha bhutani tasmadannam taduchyate iti. That it is called food, anna, because it is eaten and because it eats. The root is same, at, to consume. So it gets eaten and it eats. One may easily understand it is called food because it is eaten. But how do you say that it eats? Well, when we eat, we become that food and then get eaten in two ways. Firstly, it is eaten that when one dies for any reason, the body gets distributed into its elements and in a way gets eaten by the atmosphere or whatever. Or in a more subtle way, say I ate a cookie. Now I saw that, well, the cookie is out there, I took it and ate it. Now it is here. Now I call that cookie as I, isn't it? Just think of it. That cookie has gone in, I am showing this is I. That cookie also has thus become I. So that cookie, has it not really consumed me? That I has gone into that cookie. So in a way, while, of course, there is, the food is eaten, the food eats as well. And therefore it is to be remembered, same power that slays the eaten will also slay the eater. Your blood and my blood is not but the sap that feeds the tree of heaven. It is, it is this sap, both of us, the eaten and eat, that you have to, he says that this is how you pray to the food, that it is all laid down for the sacrifice of the tree in the heaven. Both form the sap of the tree and heaven. And when you crush an apple with your teeth, say to it in your heart, your seed shall live in my body. What a beautiful idea. Your seeds shall live in my body, and the buds of your tomorrow shall blossom in my heart. The poetry is just tremendously sublime. And the ideas expressed are so important for one's spiritual life. To feel that, yes, whatever we are taking in, that is going to get sprout in us, because that becomes our thought. The, what we eat, in a subtle manner, they make a home in us. Affect our thinking, they become our thoughts, grow in us. So it is very important in my childhood, just to keep us cautious when eating orange or something, the parents would say, hey, please take the seed out, don't eat this seed. Why? Because if you swallow a seed, the, you know, the tree will come And so I was so scared one day, I could not remove the seed quickly enough, and then with the orange the seed went in, and I couldn't sleep the whole night, kept on dreaming that the plant is coming in my belly. So, but the idea is this, that whatever you eat, you become that. Therefore, I saw a big banner, I don't know who put it, while on the road to Boston. It is no longer there, but it used to be there, that don't eat nuts, for you become what you eat. So, don't eat nuts. So, it is the funny thing is there, but the message is a very important message. And your fragrance shall be my breath. And that apple, you know, your fragrance shall be my breath. Whatever we eat, you see, our breath gets that smell. So, and together we shall rejoice through all the seasons. Then that joy, which is the essential principle of this universe, for the Hindus, the name of God is Sat Chit Ananda. Very beautiful idea, that which is existence itself. So there is no question whether God exists or doesn't exist. Existence itself gets the name God. So by very definition, by very idea, it exists. How can you say existence doesn't exist? So it is existence itself, knowledge itself, and bliss itself. It is bliss itself, not an acquired bliss from something, not an acquired pleasure from some object, that yes, it is that that pleasure is a contact-born pleasure. That is not an intrinsic pleasure at all. And therefore, not only it lasts for a tiny millisecond, it creates a more lasting reaction of suffering and craving. It is, how much pleasure do you get maybe by eating a cookie? A little bit, and that too while it goes, you know, from your tongue down up to this throat level, and then the pleasure is gone. Now then, well, its craving remains. It leaves the craving, and so you again feel, hey, I should eat the cookie. It is thus, you know, these pleasures are of that type, contact-born pleasures. And therefore, Lord Krishna tells in Bhagavad Gita that all these contact-born pleasures, they are the origins of suffering. And so a wise person does not indulge in those. All contact-born pleasures, whatever contact level there may be, it is, even when, say, the parents are hugging their baby, it is a contact-born pleasure. But it creates what? It creates bondage, sufferings, and so forth. The happiness comes and quickly goes away, and the bondage survives, because it is a contact-born pleasure. And thus, it is a very, very intensely presented idea in Bhagavad Gita. Yehi samsparshaja bhoga dukha yonaya evate, that all these pleasures, enjoyments born out of contacts, therefore are the originations of suffering. So, and therefore, natishu ramate buddhaha, wise therefore do not find pleasure in them and therefore go after them. So this is the very important idea in food. And in the autumn, when you gather the grapes of your vineyard for the wine press, say in your heart, I too am a vineyard, and my fruit shall be gathered for the wine press. And like new wine, I shall be kept in eternal vessels. And in the winter, when you draw the wine, let there be in your heart a song for each cup. And let there be in the song a remembrance for the autumn days, and for the vineyard, and for the wine press. This is a beautiful idea, friends, that remember that how we have been getting crushed, getting, you know, kept for a long time, and then consumed by somebody. That is how it is happening. And so it is, when we see this, then our mind goes towards that eternal pressure of these vines, of the grapes, and we get merged in that thought. Then let us go to the next chapter. It is, then a ploughman said, speak to us of work. We all do work, and then it is seen as a drudgery and tiresome thing, that, oh, I am so busy, I am so tired, oh my goodness, so much of work I have to do, the work seems to be unending. We all do work, and right from the morning we keep on running here, there to do the work, and at night, well, it is night, I am tired, now let me sleep. The work keeps on going on and on, never ending. Therefore, we have to remember this nature of work. Let us never think that work will end and then I will be free. No. The nature of work is it will go on expanding. It is, there we have to see that the work is to be done, therefore, again, as a matter of worship. It is that this work. Then a ploughman said, speak to us of work, and he answered, saying, you work that you may keep pace with earth and soul of the earth. For to be idle is to become a stranger unto the seasons and to step out of life's positions, and that marches in majesty and proud submissions towards infinite. So this is for that, don't be idle. One has to work. Becoming idle is the worst thing that one can do. So don't be idle. When you work, you are a flute through whose heart the whispering of the hours turns to music. See, the great idea, you know, when you work, then that is how the sound then becomes music. Otherwise, it is a noise. What is difference between noise and music? The noise has been given a form that soothes, the form that brings up some meaning. Then that noise gets called music. Thank you. So that is how there is the noise becomes music when we work. It is, which of you would be a reed dumb and silent when all else sings together in unison? Always you have been told that work is a curse and labor is a misfortune. But I say to you that when you work, you fulfill a part of earth's farthest dream assigned to you When that dream was born, everybody gets that work according to one's position, capability, situation. And that is why everybody is doing different work, not that everybody has to do the same work. And it may be that I plan to do some work, but I end up doing something else. Who knows? Somebody I was talking to this morning said that, well, if you want to see, this is an old saying, if you want to see the God laugh, then just tell your plans to God. And then you will hear a loud laugh from God. It is you plan, but then your planning is, well, I want to do this. Just look at your own stories, what you wanted to do and what you ended up in doing. It is very different, not necessarily the same. So, it is when you are a flute through whose heart, the whispering of the hours turns into music. That is how the work changes us. And then, he mentions that in keeping yourself with labor, you are in touch with life. And to love life through labor is to be intimate with life's innermost secret. But if you, in your pain, call birth an affliction, and the support of flesh a curse written upon your brow, then I answer that not but the sweat of your brow shall wash away that which is written. You have been told also that life is darkness, and in your weariness you echo what was said to be said by the weary. We all become sometimes very weary, tired, very depressed in our attitude. And then say, why did God make this situation so terrible for me? Not finding anybody else to curse. We say, why did God create this world in the first place? Shouldn't have created it at all, and then had created, at least should have done a good job. I mean, why put so much of suffering? And why suffering to a good person like me? Well, I don't mind those bad people suffering, but I am a good person. Everybody thinks I am a good person. Even, you know, so it is therefore... why me? And so it is a feeling of weariness, and you feel that it is all dark. There is no way that world can be, you know, I can feel better. But he says here that, and I say that life is indeed darkness, save when there is urge. It's a very beautiful, you know, gradually building this whole idea. It is, if there is no motivation, urge means a motivation, then life is darkness. We don't have a purpose. All urge is blind, save when there is knowledge. It is, we don't know what our urge is going to lead us to. All knowledge is vain, save when there is work. Means when you can put that knowledge into practice, that is the meaning of work here. And all work is empty, save when there is love. So the work has to be done with that tremendous love. That makes the work really change its nature. It is, no work is nobler than other work when done in love. It is said that this is a, people develop that this is a nobler work and that is less noble. This is a higher work, that is a lower work, and so forth. So that attitude is being dismissed here, that no, all work is in that sense, when done with love, it is a sacred thing. So this love has to come in the work. And it is, you know, the love, we have already spoken of love. That is what is meant by love here. Not some attraction towards something that we call love, that is I love ice cream, that is a different thing, you know. It is the love is that that feeling of totality of oneness. It in that message, if you remember, it has been shown that love is annihilation of self. You annihilate yourself, then that is love. So, therefore, this work is love made visible. Work is, what is work? Then the love becomes visible. It's a great idea. That is how a spiritual aspirant should work. So it is, when you work with love, then the work is visible. The love expresses through that work. So that is how this whole idea of working is presented. Today was the sixth class, and there is only one more class left. There are many more chapters there, but I will pick one or two from the remaining chapters to conclude this series. It has been a blessing for me to think of these beautiful these sermons given here, and a great journey also going through them. So let us conclude with the closing prayers. A quick announcement about two upcoming programs. There is at Tridib Roy's place a gathering on 19th, Saturday 19th of August in the morning, in the honor of M, the chronicler of Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. There will be a meeting. We shall have some readings, some singing and so forth. So, followed by a delicious lunch that they prepare at the home. So, those of you who want to attend, please inform Tridibda. There is on our flyer that address is given, phone number is given, or tell me at Vedanta Society that we want to go. Second program is the next day, that is on Sunday. There will be a retreat from 10 to 4 at Vedanta Society of Connecticut. The meetings are at 100 Cherrybrook Road, in Canton, Connecticut, a very beautiful place. So if you want to come for that, you are welcome. Just let me know. We can arrange the carpooling as well if you can come for that. So let us conclude with the closing prayers. Om Shanti Shanti शान्तिः हरिः ॐ तत्सत् श्रीरामकृष्णार्पणमस्तु।